This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices, episode 243, was recorded on October 29th, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, a podcast dedicated to quant and rules-based investing, helping investors overcome behavioral biases, and by FarmTogether.com, bringing farmland, a new trillion-dollar investment opportunity, within reach of all accredited investors. Variant Perception Head of Macro Research, Tian Yang, returns as this week's feature interview guest. Like most of the smartest guys we've had on Macro Voices in recent months, Tian's team sees inflation on the horizon, and they think a new secular bull market in commodities is on deck as well. We'll discuss Tian's forecast for a new commodity bull market in detail in the feature interview, but then we're going to keep it rolling as Patrick and I pick up a chart deck of commodity charts in our post-game segment, including where some opportunities may lie in the months ahead. Then, finally, we'll revisit the coronavirus outlook, with new cases and deaths both moving to new highs in both the United States and globally.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Eric, let's talk about this S&P 500. That pre-election volatility is here. And certainly we're getting these big intraday whips. But do you think it's leading to a new big trend?
Well, I think what's going on is very specific. And this is conjecture on my part. I could be wrong. But I think it's the combination of a big spike up in new coronavirus cases, plus the outlook for a Biden win, which a lot of pollsters still think is by far the more likely outcome, that would equate to probably a new lockdown for the United States, because Biden has been very outspoken in saying if the doctors and scientists recommend it, he will do another lockdown, whereas Trump has generally said the opposite. So I think a lot of the selling of stocks has been attributed to that particular concern. At the same time, I would say, however, that we're seeing stocks and bonds and even gold and Bitcoin selling off all at the same time. So that really smacks of plain old-fashioned deleveraging, liquidation flows. And that may just be ahead of election uncertainty. People are de-risking portfolios generally, selling some of everything that they've got. So it's really interesting to see how gold and bonds are performing here, not just stocks in this particular situation. I think there is a setup for an abrupt recovery in stock prices, either on a Trump win or on a reversal of the virus trends. And I think the reason that a Trump win would be an up for stocks is specifically because the market is concerned that a Biden win plus coronavirus cases spiking to new fresh all-time highs means a lockdown. And they know they're not going to get a lockdown in a Trump presidency. I would not assume that we're going to have all the answers next week because the election will have happened. I think a prolonged delay that takes potentially weeks after the election before we really know what the official result is a likelihood. So, and I think there's maybe a setup there too, where a lot of people are kind of assuming, okay, it's only one more week to the election, then we're going to know. I think that if we don't know for longer than consensus expects us not to know, if it turns into weeks as opposed to just days after the election before we get an official answer, I think that could potentially prolong and lead to further de-risking and deleveraging, pushing stock prices even lower. I think it would still be probably a setup for buy the dip eventually when we get that answer one way or the other and things start to stabilize. The only way I see it really just, you know, outright mushrooming down into a major bear market would be if there was a major uprising of civil unrest that escalates dramatically after the election, which is a distinct possibility. But I think some of that's already priced in. So as long as it's just mild civil unrest, that's probably already priced into the market.
Well, let's move on to that U.S. dollar, because certainly as we're seeing this risk-off impulse, like you were suggesting, everything was selling, the U.S. dollar has been rising in that environment. And we find ourselves a stone's throw away from the top of the multi-month range as we approach 94. Do you think the dollar has more upside, or is this just a little fake out?
Well, it might have more upside, but I would not interpret this move in the dollar as being the beginning of a new bull trend or something. What we're seeing here is a sudden and sharp turn up on the dollar, coincident with down in everything else. That is an indication of liquidation flows. People are selling stocks and bonds and gold all at the same time. That results in those liquidations result in more dollars and more demand for dollars. So I would not assume that just because we are seeing a sharp upturn here, that it means that the macro backdrop has changed and the dollar is going to, you know, appreciate to new all-time highs. I think we're seeing the other side of a liquidation trade.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil, because we've got a nasty breakdown here. What's your take on how low oil can go here?
Well, Patrick, I think there could be quite a bit more downside here, but it really is going to depend mostly on the coronavirus data and to a lesser extent on the election. Similar to what I said about the stock market, I think the combination of a Biden win plus increasing coronavirus infections makes the prospect of a U.S. lockdown more likely. That's got to have demand destruction effects on the demand for energy products. And clearly, that's one factor. It's broader, though, because the oil market is a global market. And we're already seeing, with Christine Lagarde's comments from the ECB this morning, that there is already in Europe maybe a situation which is ahead of where it is in the United States. And they're already dealing with a serious escalation in coronavirus problems, and they're already moving back into lockdown mode. So regardless of the Biden win in that aspect, which I think is having an amplified effect on U.S. stocks, oil is a more global asset, and therefore, even though, you know, we're looking at the WTI crude price when we do these reports, it's still affected by the global price of oil, and you know, there's a certain amount of transmission effect in prices between Brent and WTI. Inventory this week, crude oil building 4.3 million barrels, but we still had Cushing, Oklahoma drawing down 422,000 barrels, gasoline drawing down 892,000 barrels, and the really big drawdown distillates 4.5 million barrels. So even though we had a really big and unexpectedly big build on crude oil inventory, it was fully offset by larger net drawdowns on finished products, resulting in still a net drawdown in petroleum products on the week. The more important number in my mind, though, is not the inventory numbers, but U.S. production, not just ticking back up, but really kicking back up to 11.1 million barrels. That's up 1.2 million barrels on the week. And of course, it's not that there's a change in production that has just suddenly, you know, it's increasing at the rate of a million a week. What's going on is the storm effects, the tropical storm effects that had pushed us down to that 9.9 million barrel print that we discussed in last week's market wrap. That's been fully compensated. We've fully recovered back to where we were before the tropical storms hit the Gulf. So that pronounced decline in U.S. production that Art Berman has said we might expect by the end of Q4, it's not here yet, at least certainly not this week. Tape action, the move down in crude oil prices really started earlier in the week based on API inventory, but more so on the big increase in coronavirus cases. We'll come back to the coronavirus situation, what's going on there, and what to expect next in the postgame segment after the feature interview. Time spreads also obviously rolling over here, but still performing better than the front month contract.
All right, well, let's touch on gold, because gold looked like it was ready to break out even just a month ago, but it seems to have completely rolled over. We haven't broken the September lows yet, but it looks very toppy here. What's your take on what's going on in bullion?
Well, I think this is the most interesting market this week, because if you wanted to say, okay, the reason the stock market is selling off is because everybody's worried about election risk and there's going to be civil unrest and so forth, you'd expect gold to be up, not down. The fact that you've got stocks and bonds and gold selling off all at the same time, and gold selling off pretty hard at the same time, really says to me liquidation flows. People just de-risking portfolios completely. Some of that may be mechanized. It may be because of the volatility that we've seen in the stock market that people are just de-risking. But frankly, it's kind of a mystery in my mind to see this happen now. If we had had a clean sweep election and it was very clear who the president of the United States was, and then gold sold off as big as it has or even bigger than this, wouldn't have surprised me in the least bit. But to see this happen now, before we know what the election result is going to be, and when in fact there's probably good reason to think the election result is less certain than it was a week ago, at least that's the way I perceive it, why is gold selling off already? And I think if you did have a clean sweep and a very clear election result next week, you would see more selling in gold. The 200-day moving average is now at 1784. That would be my target if the selling continues. But the big question really in my mind at this point is, okay, how come it's happening already before the election, before we get an answer on whether civil unrest is going to escalate and the various other things that might have been holding it up? Why is it suddenly breaking down now? Could be technicals, just having broken that 100-day moving average might have led to more selling, but we've seen on a couple of daily candles now, after breaking down below that level, if it was going to, you know, just be a fake break to the downside and then suddenly recover, it would have happened by now. And even today's candle is still red as we're speaking. So it's a mystery in my mind, Patrick.
All right, well, let's finally touch on that 10-year Treasury yield, because like you were suggesting, that bonds were selling off when stocks were, and here we are, the yields at spot 8.4 on the upside. The bonds just have not acted as a hedge during this volatility. What's your take on the yields here?
Well, I think, as you say, what's going on is people are selling everything. They're selling stocks, but they're also selling bonds. They're selling gold. Why is that? Is it election related? Is it coronavirus related? I mean, those are the two big things going on. We've got a surprise increase in coronavirus cases and deaths. We'll get into that in more detail in the postgame segment. But, you know, why is this all happening at the same time? I really am surprised by it. If this had happened after the election, I might have a different view on it. But for it to be happening right now suggests to me that people are just getting more uncertain. The people that were making directional bets on what was going to happen after the election just decided to go to cash and de-risk and wait this out. One of the things that could be leading to that is the various algorithmic traders, the mechanized systems, when they get to a certain level of volatility, they just start de-risking portfolios. So it could be that what we're seeing here is risk parity funds are just starting to go through a mechanized de-risking process, selling their bonds and selling their stocks at the same time, because the correlations that they are designed to expect don't exist anymore. That's all I can think of. But something that certainly feels like liquidation flows is afoot here, and I think that also explains the move in the dollar index.
This week's feature interview guest is Variant Perception's Tian Yong. Eric, why did we invite Tian back?
Well, Patrick, the Variant Perception guys always do a great job of approaching macro from a data-driven perspective. So as we've been talking to various guests about the conceptual macro framework of the reasons why it feels like inflation might be making a comeback and why it seems like there's a big question about where bond yields are headed from here, I wanted to get somebody with a really data-driven perspective. And Tian is one of my favorite guys in that respect. And it came as no surprise to me when he sent us his slide deck. And sure enough, they're expecting a resumption of inflation and eventually a secular return to a commodity bull market. So it kind of confirms a lot of things we've been hearing from other guests, and I wanted to get it from a data-driven perspective, and the Variant Perception guys have always been good at that. Listeners, we know many of you agree with us that we're the best financial podcast on the internet because that's what iTunes and Apple Podcasts used to say about us. Unfortunately, we haven't been reminding you to do those ratings and reviews, which keep us in our number one slot, which we really feel like we deserve. And by the way, that's what helps us get the very best feature guests to come on the program. So your ratings and reviews really do help us to get better feature interviews for your future listening pleasure. Writing a five-star review for Macro Voices is simple. The instructions, step-by-step, are in your research roundup email. This episode was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. In recent weeks, we've been reminded of the fragility of world financial markets and how quickly sentiment can shift from risk-on to risk-off. Once again, the mantra of buy the dip and the determination of central banks will be put to the test. But as Chris Cole recently told us, the best approach to investing in the long run is very different from what's worked best in recent decades. To help Macro Voices listeners navigate an uncertain future, Niels Kastrup Larsen, host of the Top Traders Unplugged podcast, has created a guide to the best investment books of all time. You can get a free copy at toptradersunplugged.com/macro guide. And be sure to listen to my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup Larsen on trend following. The download link is in your research roundup email. Check out toptradersunplugged.com today. You'll be glad you did.
Eric's interview with Tien is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Tian Yang, head of macro research for Variant Perception. Tian prepared a terrific chart deck for today's interview. Registered users will find the download link in your research roundup email. If you don't have a research roundup email, that means you're not registered yet. Just go to our homepage at macrovoices.com. Look for the red button that says looking for the download above Tian's picture. Tian, it's great to get you back on the program. It's been way too long, frankly. And just looking at your slide deck, you know, it's very timely. We've been talking quite a bit on this program that I'm convinced at some point we get a secular shift to inflation. Commodities eventually have to bottom, and we see a new upcycle in commodities. And boy, that's exactly what you've got in the first half of your deck here is the next commodity supercycle, starting with inflation as a driver. So where do you guys see this inflation picture? Is it just around the corner, or could it still be a year or two off?
Thanks, Eric, and thanks for having me on the show again. As you say, I think right now there's a number of both structural and cyclical changes that are starting to come together for the next commodity supercycle. Obviously, we know over the past few years, it's been somewhat of a widowmaker trade for people to be calling the bottom. But what's very interesting is that historically, when you see major recessions, they often tend to kind of signal major trend changes or leadership changes. And obviously, coming out of this recession in 2020, we see a number of kind of quite dramatic policy shifts. That means the structural picture's changed. And obviously, in addition, what we're seeing right now is that cyclically, economies led by China starting to pick up at the same time as supply conditions actually quite constrained across a number of commodity sectors. So it's a very interesting point in time right now where, you know, we have this broader shift towards a more inflationary policy mix, a cyclical pickup in the economy. And you also have a situation where financial assets, obviously very richly valued, obviously, you know, yields are starting to hit zero everywhere, yet, you know, inflation is expected to pick up. So you're also going to have this structural flow where investors have to think about what they do with their 60-40 portfolios, what they do with their fixed income assets, and eventually have to think about shifting it away more likely into real assets. And commodities, obviously, going to be a big beneficiary of that as well. So, you know, there's a number of things kind of coming together right now to drive the next super cycle.
And where do you see the inflation story coming into this?
So I think we need to think about inflation both from a structural point of view and a cyclical point of view. So the thing to say is cyclically, obviously when unemployment rates are still quite high, when there's still capacity in the economy, you don't expect to see kind of an immediate pickup in core inflation. Obviously, headline could tick up a little bit when commodity prices, industrial commodities, so forth, initially pick up. So on the cyclical front, there's not necessarily as much inflation pressure right now. But structurally, you know, we've seen some truly seismic shifts in the kind of policy landscape and the structure of the economy, actually, just this year. You know, when you see governments and develop market governments around the world start to run giant fiscal deficits funded by central banks, that's obviously a very dramatic shift away from independent central banking and the focus on inflation. You know, this is very much going back to the old Keynesian kind of playbook of essentially, you know, fiscal-led growth. And at the same time, we've obviously seen the US Federal Reserve do a number of quite dramatic shifts this year. Firstly, you know, moving to average inflation targeting is obviously quite a big admission that they don't really know where the narrow is. They don't really care where the narrow is. They're just going to run the economy and let it run hot. And such a policy is also pretty time inconsistent because it's not well defined, you know, what's the period over which we're targeting average inflation. The incentive will always be, you know, as inflation picks up for policymakers to just run it hot because, you know, it's easier to kind of keep the party going. So, you know, both fiscal and monetary policy are starting to become a lot more expansionary and loose. And, you know, historical precedents for this kind of price action, you know, would probably go back to World War II with the Fed Treasury Accord that essentially meant, you know, fiscal deficits would be very large, but there was a moral imperative for the central banks to finance the government deficits. And that ended up creating a lot of inflation. And obviously this time around, the moral imperative is that, you know, the central bank's got to play their part with the pandemic. And obviously going into the future, the central bank probably has to play their part with addressing inequality, you know, climate change, any of these big issues that essentially justifies why central banks should finance government deficits. So that's quite a dramatic policy shift. The other thing that's happened is that the Fed is now proactively kind of destroying the quality of its balance sheet. So again, at the extreme, if we go back to, you know, when we were on the gold standard, if you look at central bank balance sheet, obviously most currency is backed by gold, right? So obviously, you know, a dollar is an asset for us, but for the central bank, a dollar is a liability. And then they back it on the asset side of their balance sheet with gold previously. Obviously, over time, as we abandon the gold standard and so forth, the quality of the central bank's balance sheet, their assets are getting worse and worse. And obviously this year, the fact that they started buying corporate bonds, the fact that, you know, they're willing to take on fallen angels, you know, high yield debt, and, you know, take on more credit risk is just another reflection of just the weakening central bank balance sheets that, again, you know, it's not necessarily immediate concern, but it lays the foundations for people to kind of increase inflation expectations to really worry about, you know, what the value of the dollar is. And so, you know, when you have these kind of structural shifts in policy coming together, coupled with the kind of deterioration in central bank balance sheets and government balance sheets, that's typically been the recipe for inflation expectations to become unhinged. So, you know, the way we've kind of described it is that we're moving towards more an ocean regime than a lake regime when it comes to inflation. So, you know, you should think of it as essentially if you have a boat that you can sail on the lake, it's probably not going to be good on the ocean. But, you know, you might be able to get away with a decent amount. But if the waves truly pick up on the ocean, then, you know, obviously a lake worthy vessel might not make it when it's faced with very big waves. And we think that's the kind of way to think about inflation right now. We're no longer on the lake. We're moving towards more of an ocean where we need to sail through. And so what investors really need to think about right now is whether there's any immediate risk of inflation or not. The key is that the risk premium that investors need to price in for inflation, especially in some of the longer duration assets, that needs to start to go up. You know, even though central banks are, you know, here, obviously we're going to have lower for longer and so forth, you know, we still have term premium being very negative. These are things that don't really make sense when we're moving to a more inflationary kind of environment. And so, you know, even over the past few months, what we've seen with the rise in yields, a lot of it's being driven by the term premium, which is obviously going from deeply negative to less negative. And so I think a lot of these things need to start to happen right now, just so investors accurately price in the risk of inflation, let alone actually seeing any inflation come through.
Tian, I love the picture on page 5 where you're talking about lake and ocean regimes of inflation. Needless to say, you're not talking about necessarily a really calm, easy day out on the ocean, but maybe a stormy day. Now, I want to go back to what you said because it seems to me that the game is very different this time around in that you drew an analogy to, okay, after World War II, we moved to a whole lot of deficit spending, which should be inflationary. The thing is, after World War II, we were still, as you said, on a gold standard. And the big inflation didn't really get unleashed until we came after the gold standard with the breakdown of Bretton Woods in 1971. Now, this time around, we're going to have, I think, the same, if not a greater shift to public policy emphasis on major, major spending programs with a lot of deficit spending. But we're already in a pure fiat environment. So nobody's pretending there's a constraint on how much money you can print in order to finance government spending. I would think that means that the inflation is certainly not delayed by 20 years the way it was after World War II. But is it immediate, or is there still a lag of several years before that inflation really hits the system in terms of consumer price inflation after those progenerative factors like deficit spending kick in? How long does it take before we really see the inflation start to get away?
Yeah, I mean, obviously that's a great question. I guess it's a little bit like, you know, when they think about how people go bankrupt, right? It happens very slowly and, you know, all at once. I think, you know, this is kind of the analogy we're kind of drawing here, because we're talking about obviously a shift in inflation expectations, which is obviously predicated on just kind of, you know, the general belief in the system. These things are obviously inherently fairly hard to predict, but what we can do is kind of position for it when it already makes sense. So when markets are already not pricing in much inflation risk premiums, and also, obviously, as the economy cyclically picks up, those are things that are going to help just drive a more kind of normal reflation cycle. So right now, if you position for that, then obviously when the tail comes through and potentially more inflation picks up later, you're kind of on the right side of it. In terms of the mechanism, you know, it could, as you say, potentially it could happen quickly or it could take a few years. I mean, if we're in a kind of 1960 style environment, then obviously what you need to do is you would need to kind of go along for the excess capacity in the economy to be used up first, and then inflation picks up, and then you will need that to feed into kind of a shifting inflation expectations higher, and then you should move into more of a wage price spiral. Then when people think inflation is going higher, they're going to demand higher wages, and that's what really kind of kicks off kind of the more uncontrolled kind of inflation right now. Arguably right now, for a lot of people, you know, say living in the United States, the actual cost of living inflation has actually already been a lot higher than what CPI would be saying. You know, if you look at shadow stats inflation and these kind of different projections, you know, they would say inflation has been running at 4-5% annually for the past 20 years, you know, if you get rid of a lot of the hedonic adjustments and so forth. And arguably, it's actually this mismatch between what official CPI says and what people feel is their true cost of living. That gap is also fueling a lot of the populism and the kind of general discontent that we have been seeing in society. And by the way, this isn't new, right? It's just quite rare that we see it in developed markets. If you take emerging market economies, say like Argentina or these places that have been known to have huge inflations, this is typically what happens. You know, the population doesn't believe in the CPI. They think their real cost of living is going up a lot higher. So when it comes to wage negotiations, you know, they demand CPI plus 5, plus 10%. And then obviously wages go up a lot more than inflation. And then you get the wage price spiral. So I think it will probably take a little bit of time for these dynamics to truly kick in the US. But the first step is obviously use up the spare capacity in the economy, which is going to generate some inflation. And then we'll see how we go from there.
Gian, let's talk about how this translates for portfolios. It sounds like we're very much in agreement that inflation's coming, but it's kind of hard to know exactly when and how it shows up. Probably when it does show up, it shows up in a big way. You don't want to be caught by surprise, but you don't know that it's happening right away. So what do you do in terms of your portfolio in order to be ready for that?
Yeah, that's kind of the million-dollar question at the moment, isn't it? So the first thing to note is, I think I mentioned briefly at the start, clearly more traditional portfolio constructs, you know, the kind of 60-40 or the heavy allocation to fixed income, it's naturally kind of getting to the end of the road. I think most people recognize that as yields bump up against kind of the zero bound, you know, the ability for your fixed income portion to really offer a diversifying impact or a hedge to the equity risk is going to obviously diminish. So, you know, going forward, what's very interesting about commodities is that one of the unique properties of commodities is typically when commodity volatility is high, commodity prices actually tend to go up a lot. And this is quite different to equities, because obviously normally for equities, only when equities are crashing that volatility picks up. Whereas for commodities, the volatility tends to be to the upside. So there's a few of these natural properties for commodities that lends itself well to mix in with equity risk. So, you know, we do see the potential for people to think a lot harder about commodities and real assets as part of their portfolios. Now, the thing to say about commodities, obviously, is that one of the big reasons why it tends to be very high volatility is that there tends to be quite prolonged periods of demand and supply mismatches for the industry, just because typically supply responses can take a long time. You know, if you're going to build a new mine or, you know, drill a new well or build a new plant, you know, it could, you know, sometimes it could take up to 3 to 5 years. Obviously, if it's like the super efficient shale well, maybe it takes 1 year to get it going. But for a lot of commodity sectors, you know, if you're going to build a refinery, right, or build a chemical plant, things like that, it's going to be 3 to 5 years. And because of that very delayed supply response, what you end up with is prolonged period of demand supply mismatches. And so that's kind of what we're starting to see right now, where for a lot of commodity sectors that are more capital scarce, there's, you know, being a prolonged period of a lack of investment, a lack of capex. And it's so, you know, these are the sectors that we would expect to have quite explosive upside as the kind of economy recovers and as demand comes back. So I think in the slide deck, there's a section, page 15, where, you know, I mentioned the capital cycle. So, and I think this is a very interesting framework to actually think about when we're trying to decide where to invest in. So, you know, the capital cycle, I think the best thing that I've read or that's really inspired us on this was some pieces written by Marathon Asset Management. And it was basically collated together in a book called Capital Returns, Investing Through the Asset Cycle. And the book was put together by Edward Chancellor. And so the basic idea is that obviously if there's a lot of money flowing to a particular industry or sector, then, you know, that inflow of money will cause a lot more competition within that industry, which drives down returns. And then as returns fall very low, then obviously nobody in the industry can make a profit. So naturally, you know, companies will need to go bust or companies will need to leave the industry. And then in turn, that restores more profitability. So, you know, lots of businesses are kind of going through these cycles over time. And what we've tried to do is take that insight and try to apply it quantitatively and essentially proxy for capital scarcity by looking at things like, you know, how much capex or R&D spending is going on in the industry relative to its asset base, you know, how much are assets depreciating, how much are assets being written down, how much are assets, you know, being amortized away, and then essentially ranking different industries using this metric. And so what's very interesting is right now what we see is that for a number of commodity-related industries, they are showing up as incredibly capital scarce right now. Oil and gas, metals and mining, precious metals, gold mining, and as gold and silver and so forth. A lot of these sectors are showing up as just very capital scarce, which obviously lends themselves well to kind of a more prolonged upcycle and kind of a longer boom period. So those are some of the things that's come out from our analysis. And so again, I think this is a quite cute way of combining a more top-down view with a more bottom-up driven approach. So that, as you say, the top-down view is very much about, you know, the shift to inflation, the fat investors are underweight, and the need to kind of, you know, for them to look for ways to hedge that inflation risk, which drives them towards commodities. And then from the bottom-up side, what we're seeing from an industry level, from, you know, balance sheet perspective, is that a lot of these commodity sectors are very capital scarce, have been for a number of years, which has caused them to delay or cancel capex projects. And, you know, it's caused supply to tighten a lot in a number of these industries so that, you know, as demand comes back or as the cycle picks up again, that there's not much room for supply to respond. So you get very outsized on price moves. You know, if we just say, look at gold, right, the kind of magnitude of the move has been quite dramatic over the past few years after a very long and lengthy kind of bear market. So, you know, that's the kind of dynamic we're trying to look for in some of these other sectors as well.
Let's talk about the pandemic and the effects that it has on the macro backdrop and where these trends are headed, because it seems to me, as we're speaking, we're just in the last few days getting a pretty significant spike in both new cases and deaths, both globally as well as in the United States. It seems to me like on the one hand, this pandemic's probably going to last longer than most people expect. The demand destruction is probably going to last longer. That has maybe some suppressive effect on prices. But boy, the capital destruction and the lack of investment that you're talking about is really being exacerbated. So it seems to me like this is really a setup for maybe prices to stay depressed because of the pandemic until they're not anymore. And then, holy cow, the upside could just be out of sight. Do you see it the same way? Am I misinterpreting that?
Broadly speaking, I would agree. The one thing I would say is, obviously, it's almost a little bit dangerous to talk about the pandemic just because it's kind of taken on such a political or moral tone when people talk about it. But obviously, what we're trying to do is just try and be objective and just follow the data and see what's going on. And actually, broadly speaking, what we're finding is that in the second and third waves for you know, developed markets, you know, like in Europe and so forth, the kind of follow through, the impact in terms of hospitalization and deaths versus back in March and April, actually, this time around, it's actually a bit lower, which is probably why governments are trying to strike more of a balance between the economy and health policy. Obviously, you know, I'm based in London, and there's a lot more of a focus on more localized lockdowns. But again, this time they're trying to keep schools open. You know, they're trying to let people keep going to work, and obviously trying to keep businesses open as well. So it does feel like the second wave is the impact is looking a lot less, and that seems to be the way the market's kind of pricing it as well. And in turn, government policy hasn't quite been as draconian as back in March, April. So, you know, you kind of have this factor, and obviously potentially, you know, vaccines and things look to be coming as well. So when you put it together, yes, you know, things are bad, but realistically, if you start to look ahead 6 months, 1 year, it seems much more likely things are going to get better than not. So on the demand side, it does feel like we're at somewhat of a nadir. And then on the supply side, as you say, you know, supply destruction has been real, right? If we look at shale, you know, the drop in production has been huge. There's been lots of bankruptcies that's come through. So yeah, it does feel like quite a rare setup that we're seeing right now. The key is obviously making sure that, you know, we position in a way that, you know, we can survive if the downturn does go a bit longer than needed, and just to capture the upside. But yeah, broadly speaking, I would agree.
John, it sounds like you and I are in very strong agreement that maybe we can't call the exact timing, but, you know, at some point, a really big move up in commodity prices driven by a combination of lack of investment, that capital shortfall that you talked about, increasing inflation expectations, deficit spending, all of these macro forces sooner or later are going to come to bear on these markets. There's lots of different ways to invest in commodities. Some people invest in the commodity itself through the futures market. Other people invest in the commodity producing companies through either ETFs or direct stock plays. Some people try to do that with a broad brush of, you know, commodity producers generally in a very broad brushed ETF. Other people are, you know, let's look at specifically which junior mining company is going to find the next uranium deposit that's going to change the world. How do you think about this at Variant Perception? If your view is commodities have a major super cycle ahead of them, are you getting positioned in the equities? Are you getting positioned in commodity ETFs? Or are you taking some different approach? How do you think about this?
Yeah, so I think it depends a little bit on, obviously, your ability to execute. But obviously, equities, and in particular, you know, investing in the equity of the producers, is probably the most simple way to do it, because obviously you can just execute once there isn't, you know, the issues with the roll and so forth. And, you know, a lot of the bad news are being priced in. And obviously, if you can find the better quality management, you know, that they can kind of help you address some of the issues with the cycle. What I would say is if you do it directly via commodities, it's doable. But what we found is that if you're going to invest directly in the commodities, you actually do still need to rebalance regularly. As I mentioned a bit earlier, the nature of commodities is that the volatility is to the upside. And so when you have a basket of commodities, what happens is often you'll get one or two that really starts, you know, going materially higher. And obviously, as a, you know, proportion of your portfolio, they tend to get very big. And if you don't regularly rebalance it and balance out the kind of relative risk distribution across the commodities you're long, it's actually quite detrimental. Like a lot of the value comes from the fact that it's very volatile. So rebalancing regularly actually allows you to kind of effectively buy low, sell high. So I think that's probably a bit harder to actually implement in practice for a lot of investors. So I think for us, we've generally gone down the route of looking at the equities. Now, the issue with the equities is that if you take a step back and look at a lot of these commodity cycles over kind of history, what we find is that because they tend to be very capital intensive sectors, they're obviously subject to kind of boom bust cycles. And the nature of boom bust cycle is that for the industry as a whole, if you buy and hold it through that time, they tend to, you know, a lot of times actually destroy value in aggregate. So then it becomes actually quite important to either time the cycle well, or it becomes very important to pick out the relative winners within the sectors and within the companies. So in our view, we're kind of trying to get the best of both worlds right now, where we feel like the timing is actually pretty good right now coming out of a recession. But at the same time, we think there are, you know, there's a lot of value to be gained from doing some stock selection right now. So for example, in something like oil and gas, broadly speaking, you can almost break it down into either very safe infrastructure, like, you know, midstream assets that you can potentially invest in. So, you know, if some, you know, if say BP Midstream or Shell Midstream, right? If they have the only pipelines that run up from the Gulf of Mexico, nobody else is going to come along and just build another pipeline alongside you, right? This is yours. This is basically the entrenched asset. So as the market picks up, this is obviously still a very good quality asset. And obviously you can pick it up for 50 cents on the dollar, let's say, right? So that would be kind of a very conservative way of doing some stock selection and then, you know, picking stuff with very good asset values that has a potential to re-rate and that can still be cash flow positive even during the downturn right now. The other way to then do it, to think about it, is look for an aggressive way to gain exposure as well. So again, digging through a little bit in terms of the quality producers, say on the E&P side, guys that have more track record, you know, the Lunding family obviously have a very good track record, you know, companies like Parex and so forth have, you know, generally considered to be, you know, well-managed, better quality assets. And so, you know, these are where you're investing, knowing that if the prices go up, the upside can be a lot higher than some of the, say, infrastructure type plays, but also with a bit more risk. So, you know, I think that's probably the way to play it. Actually, yes, timing-wise is good. And then going for the ETFs, you'll probably be okay. But if it's possible to do some more kind of stock selection on top, there will likely be a lot of value add just because the nature of boom-bust cycles in industries in general is that there tends to be a lot of also-rans, you know, in the industry that historically have destroyed a lot of shareholder value.
Let's break this down in terms of categories of commodities. Obviously, energy is central to the economy, and I think there's lots of reason to want to really look after this election to where the trends are going to be headed in terms of green energy and so forth to make some investment decisions there. But you move on to base metals. Copper, of course, is the widely respected proxy for the general economy. So copper mining seems like a place, if you're getting ready for a big economic expansion, a lot of infrastructure spending, seems like a place to be. Agriculture is probably going to get more important. Precious metals. How do you think about the whole world of commodities and how do you approach those sectors in terms of where you allocate?
Yeah, so obviously, you know, ESG and green energy and the energy transition are, you know, very important kind of secular trends. But I think the nature of these trends is that they do tend to take time. And actually, the history of a lot of commodity cycles, how things have ended, you know, how the coal cycle has done previously, you know, whale oil, you know, rubber, there's been a lot of, you know, secular commodity boom bust cycles I've already seen. You know, over history, we have previous examples of, and usually these cycles are heavily politically driven at the end. So it's not so much economics, it tends to be politics that comes into it. So certainly, you know, if we're looking at energy, some of the more fossil fuels, the headwind is there. But the thing to note is that, you know, the investment is almost a bit like the worst case is you're treating it like, you know, a last stance kind of investment, right? Things are so bad, but it's still so essential to the economy that there's at least one more upcycle in it. And even the most aggressive kind of net zero by 2050 plans, you know, you're still going to give a lot of these industries kind of a 5 to 10 year window that's actually not that dissimilar from the norm. And obviously from 2030 onwards, a lot of the transitions are expected to kind of accelerate. So I think those medium term headwinds are certainly there. And obviously they're more argument against the kind of buy and hold forever case. But what they also do is obviously discourage a lot of CapEx and investment and R&D into the sector. So if anything, in terms of what these longer term headwinds are doing is they're exacerbating the current kind of supply demand imbalance. So you're just going to have a situation where supply is going to be constrained for the foreseeable future. Nobody wants to invest here. Yet as the economy recovers and picks up, you know, there's still a lot of demand. You know, obviously the transition to electric vehicles and so forth, there's a lot of argument about how quickly it happens. But, you know, I just use simple rules of thumb, right? If I think about how long, you know, cars are well made, you know, a typical new car can probably last, what, like 10, let's say like 6, 7, 8 years, right? I mean, most cars, you can probably drive it for 10 years and it's still quite good right now. So if overnight everybody stops using petrol-fueled or diesel-fueled cars and moves to electric, because the average car is used for 7, 8, 9 years, it's still going to take you that long, right, to slowly phase out. And that's obviously at the most extreme, assuming everyone changes overnight. So I think it's just more, these are factors that for the more traditional fossil fuels, they are headwinds, but a lot of it does seem to be in the price. So there you're very much going for like a more value play plus kind of cyclical rebound. On something like copper, that's probably where you're trying to be more aligned with the kind of ESG mega trends and so forth. So one of the very interesting things is that obviously because you don't have the ESG or the green headwinds, the valuations will obviously for those sectors naturally be a bit higher. But at the same time, you're a lot more likely to benefit from a kind of arms race between, say, the US and China to go out and electrify and, you know, go for green technology and to build out, you know, electrical grids and build out, you know, charging stations, all these things. So I think that they do still broadly fit because they're all capital scarce, but conditional on them being capital scarce, obviously energy, fossil fuels are much, much cheaper in terms of valuation than some of the other sectors. But obviously the play is a bit different, right? If you go for the fossil fuel, you're going for more value. You're going for kind of the last hurrah big cycle, at least, right? Whereas if you're going for the copper or some of the other battery related, right? So like, you know, lithium, nickel, and a lot of these sectors, one is a lot of the other ones probably aren't as capital scarce because, you know, people are kind of more open to investing there. And obviously when you have more capital available, it actually is not so good for investor returns. But the plus side is that potentially, you know, because of the world we're living, you know, geopolitics, you know, the kind of arms race in trying to transition economies towards more greener technologies, that, you know, we've seen China, you know, their voracious appetite for a lot of these commodities, right? China consumes half the world's copper, but only, you know, they only have 5% of the production. So they're going around the world trying to buy up mines, secure supplies everywhere. And obviously, as depending on who comes in, obviously the polls suggest Biden comes in, but regardless, we also see that for a lot of developed countries as well, there's a more shift towards embracing fiscal spending, infrastructure spending, and so forth, that again necessitates, you know, more demand for commodities.
It certainly makes an argument for copper because you've got the double win that an infrastructure spend is going to benefit copper and a green spend is going to benefit copper because of the electric vehicle play. Are there any other, you know, double whammies that you can think of for investors where there's a double win in a particular play that really makes sense?
So the challenge with it is not so much just a double win. I think it's whether it's in the price, it's in the valuations and what's embedded. So I think that's the challenging thing. You know, obviously for battery technology things, you know, as I mentioned, lithium, nickel, some of these minerals are actually going to be quite important, you know, rare earth metals, right? These are all things that ultimately are going to be quite essential. But, you know, in terms of where they're priced, it's probably not as cheap as some of the more fossil fuels. So I think it's more investor preference in the trade-off rather than necessarily picking one in the absolute sense. I think copper is one we've chosen to highlight because it's still in somewhat of a sweet spot where the industry is being flagged as actually being very capital scarce, and yet it has this double whammy kind of tailwind behind it of infrastructure or green energy. So I think that's what is probably somewhat more unique about copper versus some of the other ones where it's not really as capital scarce.
And how do precious metals fit into this whole story?
Yeah, so obviously gold and silver are slightly different in that, you know, a lot of investors don't think of them as commodities, but more as just obviously an alternative to fiat currency. So, and obviously because of that property, it does fit in with the kind of whole inflation, changing inflation regime we've discussed. But what makes gold miners and silver miners very interesting is that there's potentially, you know, a bit more upside than even owning the metals themselves. Owning the metals themselves, obviously, is just more part of the classic hedge. And obviously, if you want to own physical gold, it's about, you know, also dealing with the fact that potentially not only the world's going to turn more inflationary, but perhaps, you know, taxes are going to pick up. There's going to be more expropriation of wealth. You know, a lot of these trends that typically accompany kind of a more inflation regimes, right? Or that tend to come out from very unequal societies. So owning the physical metal is kind of the ultimate hedge against a lot of those things. So, you know, that aside, assuming you don't care as much about some of these more more risk, you know, risk like expropriation and so forth. If you're willing to kind of live with that risk, then what's interesting is obviously gold miners are still relatively cheap compared to the gold themselves, because obviously as a sector, you know, gold last peaked in 2011. You know, the sector's been through kind of almost 8-9 years of a prolonged bottoming bear market process. You know, capital's fully dried up. So it's a very, very capital scarce sector. So for the guys that are surviving, who still have, you know, the reserves in the ground and the operations, you know, they're potentially set to really benefit, you know, now the gold prices are picking up and they can start mining and really churning out cash flow. So they're, you know, all the same arguments we talked about, right? You know, inflation and so forth apply for precious metals, but going for the miners potentially gives you that extra bit of performance on the upside. And the trade-off is obviously that, you know, you don't get to own the physical gold. So if you're really, really worried about, you know, rising taxes, appropriation, you know, you need to have your gold in a vault in Switzerland, but then obviously you probably want the physical.
Well, Tian, I can't thank you enough for another terrific interview. It's great to have you back. Before I let you go, tell us a little bit more about what you do at Variant Perception and where people can find out more about your work.
Yeah, so Variant Perception is a data-driven independent research provider. So we're essentially trying to come up with very macro top-down views backed up by data. And then when the top-down data leads us to interesting places, we'll go and do some micro work and come up with a broad thesis as well. So if, you know, listeners are interested in a trial or to see some of our reports, please visit variantperception.com and fill out the necessary forms there.
It's great to have you. We look forward to getting you back in a few months for another update. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor. Farmland investing has been a popular macro trend among billionaires and big institutions for the last decade. But the high cost of buying an entire farm put this asset class out of reach to all but big institutions and the ultra-rich. FarmTogether.com allows any accredited investor to invest in fractional ownership of several different categories of farmland. I recently did a full-length interview with FarmTogether.com founder and CEO, Artem Milinchuk. We discussed the macro argument for farmland investing, performance and correlation comparisons to conventional asset classes, and the different types of farmland and their investment characteristics. If you're an accredited investor, I recommend that you listen to that interview and learn why farmland investing might be a fit for your portfolio. You can find the download link in your Research Roundup email, or just type the word farmland into the search box on our homepage at macrovoices.com. Check out farmtogether.com today. You'll be glad you did.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Tian. I'm looking forward to getting into the commodity chart book and talking about all sorts of the commodity trends. But we got a lot of feedback about our show last week with Stephanie Kelton. What's your take on all of that?
You know, it was really interesting, Patrick. We've got more feedback on last week's episode than any other episode we've ever done in 5 years of Macro Voices. And what I really found interesting, whether it was the tweets on Twitter or the emails that we received, there were just so many polarized responses. Some people are just hailing Stephanie Kelton as the visionary savior of the world, the angel who's going to rescue the economy from damage done by capitalism or whatever it is. And then we've got about an equal number of Stephanie Kelton is the Antichrist. I can't believe you had her on your show. And it's really amazing to me, Patrick, because what I don't think most of the people responding really seem to take to heart is, you know, I'm not endorsing MMT as a good idea. Frankly, I don't think it is. But I'm telling you, it's coming. And the most important lesson I've ever learned in investing is not to focus on what you want to happen or what you think should happen or what you're convinced the best thing for the world is, but rather, what are the other people doing? What's the market doing? And what's going on here, whether you like it or not? And I don't happen to like it. is the view that Stephanie Kelton is advocating, which is that it's a good idea for governments to print all the money they need and only be constrained by inflation starting to run away. That's gaining a huge amount of political traction, and I think that governments are likely to print a whole bunch more money before this is over. I'm really encouraged those of you who were writing in with angry messages about Stephanie Kelton and body parts and four-letter words. Look, get over it and just accept that whether we like it or not, it's happening. And you've got to start to think about how to structure your portfolio around a reality that you might not happen to personally agree with. But I'll get off my soapbox now. Let's move on to the post-game chart book. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means that you're not registered yet at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, look for the red button that says looking for the downloads just above Tian Yang's picture. Patrick, commodities and commodity stocks. Let's keep the ball rolling from the great interview we just did with Tian and actually get into the charts and look at this. Starting just as a point of reference before we get to commodities with the S&P 500 stock index on page two. What do you make of this chart? We haven't quite taken out those September lows yet, but kind of looks like that's coming.
I think the pre-election volatility is exactly that. I mean, we had a little bit of a circumstance where dealers are not providing the same amount of liquidity they were before for risk management purposes. At the same time, there's a very large move to deleverage portfolios. And so it's an imbalance, but it's likely an imbalance that lies just before the elections rather than some sustained trend into the new year, at least until we see the results. After the election results, there might be new trends emergent, but I don't necessarily think you want to overread into the most immediate price action as a forecast as to where the markets are going to move forward. But I really wanted to capture just this chart in reference to what's happening in the Euro stock on page three. And what's interesting is how the tail is very different in Europe. Obviously, the most recent breakdown is because of the new wave of lockdowns that they're doing across Europe from coronavirus, which we'll talk about toward the tail end of this session. But what is interesting is the Euro stock never made it back to those February, March highs and spent the majority of the summer over the 4 months consolidating sideways before breaking down. The European and many developed markets actually look much more bearish than the US equity markets. And I just thought it was important to reference that when looking at equities. On page four, I wanted to just reference the dollar because we are going to talk commodities, and one of the drivers of commodities and reflation cycles is currency trend. And so it's interesting that the dollar did not break down to a lower low, and rather now we continue to see the establishment of a consolidation zone throughout the summer in August, September here along that 92 to 94 level. I think it's going to be a really important determinant of the short-term commodity cycle as to which way this dollar moves in the post-election period. And I think that's something that we have to watch very closely, right?
I couldn't agree more, but again, with the caveat that the big action that we're seeing in the last couple of days, I don't think there's a new macro impetus that's driving the dollar higher. I think it's just the other side of liquidation flows. For some reason, ahead of this election, people got spooked. Maybe it's the combination of the election and the coronavirus fears that have suddenly really hit the tape. People are selling everything, and that results in dollar up, everything else down.
And so this is where I wanted to go through some of the different commodities, because so many things that Tian was saying, I wholeheartedly agree with. In fact, I'm very bullish commodities in general in terms of the opportunity. Of course, the issue with all these commodities in many cases is that they're trading very poorly and they've been consolidating for extended periods of time. And the real opportunity, this bull market, is about identifying when some of these major lows will come in and establish the next big buying opportunity. And no better example of that is the energy space. So I wanted to start here with this crude oil chart. And we can see that it's breaking to multi-month lows. We haven't seen these kind of levels on crude oil since that May-June period where oil was off of those incredibly awful levels where it was during that crash where the front month went negative. What's going to be really interesting is that if you take, let's say, the bottom of gold and silver during 2015 and 16, there was these prolonged periods where they spent basing and retesting lows to establish where the ultimate bottom comes in. One of the things that I'm going to be watching here on crude is, in spite of all of the demand issues and all of the pressure that's coming here, if crude oil does not make it all the way back to its previous lows and establishes higher lows and really consolidates in here, that might be a really good base to lean on when starting to buy at some point in the new year. But it certainly looks really weak here for the next few weeks for sure.
Yeah, I think it's going to be really interesting to see what those next few weeks bring. We've been predicting, as our regular listeners know, I've been anticipating all summer long, I thought we would get a test of the low 30s. Finally, we're either starting to do that or just on the cusp of it or something. One of the things I think that can be a little misleading just looking at this particular contract chart, if you look back at the April highs on this chart, it looks like we're actually already below that level. But the reason for that is this is the contract chart. It's just the December contract. And back in April, the December contract was nowhere close to being the front month. Now it is the front month contract. And that distorts the chart a little bit. If you look at a continuous contract chart, you see that the April high was around $28 and change, still well below the current market. And I would say that is kind of a target that I think about. You can't see it on this particular chart, but if you look at a continuous contract chart and you look at where that April high is, it's $28, almost $29. In that range is where I would kind of expect things to bottom out in this cycle, unless we get a major escalation of the coronavirus crisis where it turns out the second wave is much worse than the first wave and the whole world goes back into lockdown and everything is completely shut down again. Short of that, I think that somewhere between 29 and 33 is likely to be my best guess for where this current trend is going to bottom out. Could be that it's already over, but we've still got a week till the election. Coronavirus numbers are getting higher every day. I think we've still got room to go lower here. I'll be surprised if we get, let's say, below 26 at any point here on the front month contract. That would really say to me that things are substantially breaking down, and who knows where we're headed from there. I don't think it's going to happen, though. I would guess that 26 is an extreme, and a more likely target is around 28.50 or so for this move.
Right. And so I want to move on and just touch on what's going on in the energy companies, because Tian was talking about the idea of some opportunities in the energy equity space. And so the next three charts, page 6, 7, and 8, I have the energy ETFs. Starting on page 6 is just the much broader energy trust ETF by the SPDR, the XLE. And what's particularly interesting about the energy space is that while oil continued to press higher all the way out into August, what's interesting is the energy stocks all peaked out in early June. And by the time August rolled around, they were already in a multi-month consolidation, 10, 20, 30% off of their highs in many cases. And what's interesting is that these energy stocks that have been pretty much in a clean downtrend for 6 months are slowly approaching the lows they saw all the way back in March. And while the ETF hasn't made it all the way down there, some of the big behemoths like the Exxon Mobils were literally testing their closing lows from March. And so at some point, I asked the question, when have these energy stocks already priced in all of this this weakness in oil? They've been selling a lot sooner than oil turned, and they're already at levels where when crude was down in the 20s and even lower. And so it'll be really interesting to see whether or not we start to see bottoms establish themselves in the energy company space. But moving on to chart 7, I have the Alerian MLP ETF, symbol AML. LP. And what's interesting about this is that when Tien was talking about the midstreams and a lot of pipeline and other plays, and what's interesting is that this is one of these big, high dividend paying plays on these MLPs. And what's interesting is that this right now is paying an extraordinary large dividend, largely because I think most investors are anticipating dividend cuts. And what the question is how much of it has been priced in and how deep will those dividend cuts inevitably be? Because at some point, locking in some of these really cheap prices for these big, robust dividends may actually be a really interesting idea. And finally, on page 8, what I wanted to just touch on was the Vanek Vector's Oil Refiners ETF, a symbol CRAK. And what we've seen as well is the gasoline demand has generally been weak and the crack spreads have been incredibly narrow. I think most recently they dropped all the way down to a $7 spread. And what we're seeing is a lot of those refiners just all the way back down to the lows, whether you're talking about like a Holly Frontier already breaking below March lows or the Phillips 66s of the world, they've all been incredibly weak. And it's going to be really interesting if there is some sort of a commodity bull market that's going to come on the other side of it. With these all of these sectors in many cases trading very close to all-time lows, the question is this starting to get to that level where you back up the truck and start buying up some of these companies, knowing that inevitably, if you have a long enough time horizon, there's big money to be made. As an example, for many of these energy companies, if they just return back to the highs they had in June, when coronavirus already was priced in, many of them are doubles from these levels. And so it's really interesting to see what kind of opportunities may emerge here.
You know, I do think that there's plenty of room to see a double bottom or even a new lower low on these energy names. And the reason is, if you remember the market mindset back in the spring, despite the fact that we had this epic crisis on our hands, everybody was talking about, okay, is the vaccine that cures everything and gets the V-shaped recovery, you know, totally launched 3 months away or is it 6 months away? And the idea that there's really no good reason to expect a functional vaccine anytime soon, considering that there's never been an RNA virus vaccine that's been effective in humans ever, it wasn't sinking in. Everybody assumed it was just around the corner. And I think what you're seeing in these charts and the reason that crude oil is performing differently than the equities is at the time when you saw that big rally happening in May and into the beginning of June, whether it be on the XLE or on crack or what have you, the assumption was this horrible thing has happened, but you know the worst is over and it's all ending now. The idea that the virus crisis might come in multiple waves, that it might become endemic, that it might be something that we just have to learn to live with, and that it could be affecting the economy for the next 10 years. Nobody was ready to listen to any of that back then, and now they're starting to get it. So I think that there is potential, especially if we do get another wave of the crisis that freaks everybody out. People are panic selling. I think you could easily see a new lower low on some of these stock prices. I don't think you're going to go to a lower low than minus $40 on front month crude oil, but to get to a new lower low in the stocks, I think is entirely possible. And I do think it would be a great buying opportunity because whether there is a vaccine or we just learn to live with this, one way or another, life is going to go on. We're going to eventually figure things out. And there's always going to be demand for energy.
That's right. So moving on to the uranium chart on page 9. I mean, we had that great uranium special just a few weeks back and just wanted to look at where the charts are. I mean, overall, the spot price of uranium has been slightly consolidating off of its highs. But overall, it really does look like uranium bottomed back in 2016 and 17. And really, we've seen it slowly starting to improve. And what's interesting is that when we go to page 10 and look at where uranium stocks are trading, or the miners of uranium, this is the North Shore Global Uranium Mining ETF, the URNM. We can see here that we're at highs near $34 on this, in a very nice uptrend that was established off the March low. And really, the last 2 months has seen a pretty clean and substantial correction. And it'll be really interesting as we approach those consolidations in late 2019 and throughout May and June of this year, whether this is going to be where a short-term bottom establishes itself and whether there'll be a buying opportunity here.
Yeah, and I think that it, if you look at what happened in March too, there was no real logical reason for uranium to sell off the way it did. It sold off because everything was selling off and, people were panicking. I think that if we do get, whether it be election uncertainty or if it's a result of another wave of coronavirus, if we get another market freakout where, everybody is just selling everything and uranium tanks again, it doesn't even need to go as low as it did. If we get back down to anything close to those March lows, I would be buying it hand over fist. I'm really kicking myself because I was following the uranium story after we'd interviewed Marin Katusa on it a couple of times. And I didn't think of it in March when it hit those low numbers. I wasn't paying attention. I wish that I'd bought that bottom when it happened. And I wouldn't be surprised if we had another opportunity where uranium prices get distressed and it's a real back the truck up opportunity. I've already got some URNM in my portfolio, but I would certainly add more if we had another March type of event.
So I wanted to just quickly touch on gold on page 11. And this is, we already talked about this in the at the start of the show, when the market wrap, just the way gold is rolling over. And, the idea that gold could consolidate towards where it was consolidating back in April, May, and June, just below 1800, is entirely on the table if it breaks to that September low. But one of the interesting things is that it is still a very distinct uptrend. And these types of market corrections tend to backfill and correct such big advances. And so what will be really interesting is will we see that this is just contained to like a 50% retracement of that big rally? And if it does, will the buy on dips emerge from there? It's going to be interesting. But what I wanted to really, though, talk about is page 12, which is the gold miners themselves. And Tian also talked about them in there as an opportunity. And what's interesting is that the gold miners, the gold miners more or less seem pretty correlated to gold, as they pretty much peaked in the same week and have been more or less consolidating. But it'll be interesting to see whether or not these gold miners do consolidate in a similar manner down into the low 30s, and whether that's going to be where the compelling buy on dip opportunity emerges.
I agree, Patrick, and I think it's going to be really interesting to see what happens with this election outcome, because once we get past the uncertainty phase, even if there is a modest increase in civil unrest, if it's not outright mayhem, I think there's room for gold to sell off some more and to, as you put it, backfill some of that exuberance. We saw a lot of upside as a result of election uncertainty and civil unrest increasing over the summer and so forth. As we get into the fall, where the civil unrest is likely, just for weather reasons, at least in colder cities, people will be less likely to be out on the streets of Seattle and Portland protesting in the cold weather. The election result will, one way or another, be known at some point. I think the ingredients are there, unless there's a major up move in civil unrest, which, again, I have suggested is entirely possible. If we don't get outright mayhem, I think there's plenty of room for gold to correct much deeper. And I would say the first target is the 200-day moving average at 1783, but you certainly could look lower than that for where we might go before this is over. Back down to the 1500 level, say, would not surprise me at all, and it wouldn't change my very bullish long-term view on gold. The further down it is, the bigger the buying opportunity.
So moving on to copper on page 13, copper has been actually one of the most bullish commodities. And Tian was also talking about that and the opportunity that's there in the commodity. It'll be interesting to see whether it can maintain this entire consolidation to just like one of these 1 to 2 week kind of corrections that maybe in the post-election period bullishly turn up. What is interesting is when we look on page 14, when we look at the Global X Copper Miners ETF, COPX. It's been such a beautiful uptrend in the copper miners off that March low. And we're finally reaching that overhead resistance where they're just consolidating sideways. And some technicians will, you know, start to fish around whether that will establish some sort of double top formation. But I think that when you really zoom out onto those weekly charts and see just how decimated the space has been over the last many years, I think that all the dips are likely to be bought. And any consolidation here is just probably going to end up being a good opportunity to position yourself in some of these miners.
I agree, Patrick. And of course, the opportunity that I'd really get excited about, we know that copper is always a barometer for industrial activity, which means if there is a big increase in coronavirus infections and deaths, copper is probably going to take a nosedive on expectations of slowing economic activity and slowing industrial activity. In the short term, there could be a lot of downside there. But long term, it's a buying opportunity. You know that coming out of this, there's going to be more stimulus. There's going to be more government attitude toward electric vehicles, which are big copper consumers, towards infrastructure build out, which is a big copper consumer. There's just all kinds of good reasons to be long-term bullish on copper. And I think the coronavirus crisis, if we get another significant wave here that really makes things worse, could easily create a really good buying opportunity.
All right. And let's wrap up this particular chart series with looking at the volatility index. And this is something we talked about last week. And I was just showing the 2016, just how volatility imploded in the days after the elections and how there was this big volatility premium as everyone's grabbing left tail insurance. And in this case, we even have a lot of right tail insurance buying as there's some big players out there that are throwing some billions of dollars into some call spreads on the upside of the S&P. Nonetheless, what's interesting is that on page 16, when we look here, we had a big spike in implieds just yesterday. I mean, we hit the 40 handle on the VIX, and it's starting to look a little deja vu like of 2016. And while maybe the stock market outcome may not be exactly the same, it'll be really interesting to see whether volatility normalization happens in the post-election period and whether this VIX starts heading back down to the low 20s and whether it even happens as rapid as it did back in 2016. Nonetheless, Eric, we all added some charts here on starting on page 17 on the coronavirus cases. And we just really wanted to get an update from you on like, what's going on here and what are you seeing with this new second wave of the coronavirus around the world?
Well, it's really interesting, you know, just looking on Twitter at how divided people are and how much, especially in the United States, this has become a political affiliation thing. The people's opinion as to whether or not deaths are on the rise or not kind of depends on whether they're Democrat or Republican. And, you know, I personally prefer to just go on the data. So let's take a look at these actual charts. And these are from Worldometers, the sources at the bottom of the page there on page 17, if you want to look at it yourself. Cases and deaths are both increasing on the left side of page 17. More importantly, though, if we look at the daily new cases, which really gives us a better insight into how the trends are going, yesterday we saw the first time ever more than 500,000. I think the number was 507,000 new cases globally. Now, a lot of people will tell you the case counts are completely misleading because the better that we get at testing, the more people we test, the more cases get detected. The cases might have been there all along and we just didn't detect them. And what you'll hear people say a lot is, therefore, the case counts are really not meaningful. You have to look at the deaths, and those have been consistently declining for months. Okay, let's look at the right-hand side of page 17. If you're convinced that those are declining and have been for months, as depicted on page 17, I think you've got to have a talk with yourself about how much your political ideology is affecting your ability to interpret data, because we're not seeing deaths declining for the last several months. What we're seeing is a resumption. Now, it's not back to a new high the way the cases are. And I think the reason for that is in the beginning of this crisis, we didn't know how to treat this. We were putting people on ventilators when that was really what we thought it was, mostly a respiratory disease. We didn't understand it was more of a bloodborne disease. We didn't know how to treat it yet. We've gotten much better now at understanding what the nature of this disease is and how to treat it. That's the reason that we got off the big spike. But look what happened there. Before you even got to the end of June, it was already starting to increase again. And then we did have a bit of a reprieve there, but now we're seeing an increase as we get back into the colder weather in the Northern Hemisphere. So it's clearly not over yet. The cases are at radically new highs in terms of how many cases. I think that is being affected to some extent by testing skewing the results, where we weren't doing as much testing 6 months ago, and so it exaggerates the number. But those death numbers are not exaggerated, and they're moving back to their previous highs. Now, page 17 is showing us global statistics. Let's move on to United States statistics on page 18. You see the new cases total on the left side, and then the daily new cases. And of course, we are moving to all-time records in terms of new cases per day above 80,000. But again, there is an argument to be made that maybe the cases are being affected more so than the deaths by better testing. Let's move on to page 19. And you see, even in the case of daily deaths, yeah, it's not above 2,000 daily deaths the way it was in the heights of the April crisis, where this was new, hospitals were overwhelmed, they didn't know how to respond to it, they didn't know how to treat it. Things really got crazy for a while there. But frankly, we're back up to consistently more than 1,000 deaths per day. And if you look at this chart overall in terms of the daily counts, it's not declining over a period of months like people will tell you. It's stabilizing. That's a good thing, but if you consider that we're getting better and better at treating this disease, and there are therefore less number of deaths per number of serious cases, then, you know, these numbers are really not very comforting. What I don't have here is a chart of hospitalizations. I would love to have that chart, because I think that's a good indication of seriousness of cases, although that's also constrained somewhat by hospital capacity. But in general, you know, the idea that you'll hear being thrown around that cases have been declining for months and it's all getting better is really not true. And we're seeing a big new uptick in cases that may lead to, there's always a delay between the case uptick and the death count uptick because the disease requires several weeks to progress. We need to be looking sometime around early December at whether or not there is an accordant spike in deaths that really match this big spike we're seeing right now in cases. And I think it's likely that there will be. So already Europe is going into more lockdowns. I think the global trend, what you're going to see is there will be calls for lockdowns in the sense that we'll have just as much of a sentiment among doctors and scientists saying it's time for the government to lock things down again. But I think you'll have a much more outspoken social objection to that, where people say, we just want to get on with our lives. We object to being locked down. We'll accept the risk. Let's move on with life and just keep on going. Of course, the presidential election in the United States will strongly influence the U.S. government's stance on this, because President Trump and Vice President Biden have had very opposite policy statements about what they would do in the face of recommendations to go into another another full-on U.S. lockdown. If that were to be recommended by scientists, Biden would do it. Trump wouldn't do it. The rest of the world is already doing it. So how big is this next wave as we get into cold weather in the Northern Hemisphere? Is it going to be bigger than the first wave and have more economic damage, or have we already seen the worst of it? We don't know yet, but we need to be paying close attention to this and leave the politics out of it. Something else I wanted to cover here in today's episode, because nobody seems to ever talk about it, is to look at these data on a per capita basis, because you hear so much where people say, well, a certain country had X number of new deaths or new cases, and you know that country is worse than this country. They're not adjusting it for the population sizes of those countries. It doesn't make any sense. What you care about is the per capita total cases and the per capita total deaths. It's a sort column that's available here on worldometers.com, just nobody ever seems to click on it. So I just wanted to show first on page 20, this is a ranking essentially from worst at the top to better as we go down lower in terms of which countries have been hardest hit in terms of the percentage of their population becoming infected. And the sort column is total cases per million population, which is about two-thirds of the way across there. The top number says 58,430 for Andorra. Well, some of these smaller countries, Vatican City with a grand total of 27 cases, obviously their numbers per million population are skewed by their very small populations. But for the big countries on this list, like Belgium and Kuwait and the United States, obviously, this is a much more meaningful ranking. And the United States is number 14 on this list. So we're not the worst in the world, but we're really not doing all that great, considering we've got more money and resources to throw at this problem than just about anybody else. This is, again, total cases. A lot of people think the case counts are skewed because of different amounts of testing. Moving on to page 21, we're sorting now per capita total deaths. And it's very interesting. Going back to page 20, you see the United States has moved above on the list, meaning worse than a lot of the South American countries like Chile and Brazil and Peru, which were really hard hit over the North American summer, which of course was their winter. As you move on to page 21, though, you see that the United States is still doing better than Spain and Chile and Brazil and so forth. So I, for one, find it very interesting to kind of rank the performance of various different governments in handling this crisis by their per capita cases and particularly their per capita deaths. The United States at number 10 worldwide in terms of having the most per capita deaths. It's not number one. It's not the worst in the world. But with 210 countries or whatever are in the world, the U.S. is in the worst 10 countries in terms of cases and deaths per million population is really a pretty damning statement when you consider that the United States is richer and has more resources to fight this crisis than just about anyone else. Moving on to page 22, we'll take a look at the same numbers ranking U.S. states. And I find this very interesting, too. Who would have guessed that North Dakota was the worst state in the United States on a per capita basis? Well, of course, they don't have as much capita, so a smaller number of cases will have a big effect. But on a per capita basis, North Dakota, as you can see, is at the top of the list. And this is infections per capita. As we move on to deaths per capita on page 23, New Jersey, New York, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Louisiana are the worst states. And that's kind of consistent with what we've heard in terms of the reporting about where the worst outbreaks have been. So it seems like the deaths rather than the infections are the more telling statistic here. But I find it very interesting just to see these rankings of how different states have performed on a per capita basis as opposed to total numbers, which is what you hear the mainstream media reporting. We're already over time, folks, so we're going to leave it there for this week's episode. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by FarmTogether.com, making farmland investing a $1 trillion asset class available to all accredited investors, and by toptradersunplugged.com. Remember to get the ultimate guide to the best investing books ever written at toptradersunplugged.com/macro guide. For information on sponsoring Macro Voices, please visit macrovoices.com/sponsor info. Listeners, be sure to register a free account at macrovoices.com. The benefit to you is you'll receive our Research Roundup email, which provides you with all of the best free content that we could find on the internet each week, including downloads associated with our guest appearances, as well as, of course, our post-game chart books. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
This week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the Variant Perceptions presentation slide deck, as well as the chart book we just discussed here in the postgame. There's also a link to the Variant Perception blog titled Elections Come and Go, as well as a link to an article on OPEC production cuts could be extended. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account, @MacroVoices, for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter, @EricSTownsend, and myself, @PatrickSerezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email, containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.